This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most successful writers have the satisfaction of seeing their work in print and perhaps hearing the praise that accompanies that success. Not Henry Dumas. He died on a subway platform in New York at the age of 33, just before most of his work had been published, before he and his work had been praised as genius. Dumas was a product of the American South of the 30s and 40s and the Civil Rights Movement, but he was also influenced by religion, Christianity, Islam, even Sufi mysticism, by jazz, and by musicians, and by Moms Mabley. His life was shrouded in contradiction, but his contributions to writing are clear, and those contributions and the story of Henry Dumas's life have been chronicled in Visible Man, The Life of Henry Dumas, by UNC Charlotte professor and director of the Center of the Study of the New South, Dr. Jeffrey Leek, who joins us for the hour. Welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be back. Thank you.
Good to see you again. Dr. Leek will be having a book signing party at Park Road Books on Saturday, June 21st at 2 p.m. It was after Henry Dumas's death, as I just said, just shy of the age of 34, that his work started to emerge. His friends pushed the publication of his work posthumously. How well known was he during his life, though?
Well, he was known in black arts circles, and not just black arts, but he had a number of acquaintances, white artists, white writers in the New York area. And so within the New York and New Jersey, even writing scene, people knew who he was. Amiri Baraka, for example, knew who he was. Other poets, other novelists knew. People like John Oliver Killens knew who he was. But beyond that, he hadn't had the kind of exposure up to the point when he was killed that would have made him more of a standard or household name.
And some of the people that he, some of his acquaintances, some of his friends turn out to be, later in life, relatively high-profile people in the literary world. Of course, they too were, what, the contemporaries of his.
So right.
They hadn't
right.
achieved that yet. But Toni Morrison and others pushed to get his work published. What did they see? What did she see in him?
Well, Morrison in particular said that in his work, in his fiction in particular, that there was a kind of voice that she had never heard before, and that it needed to be out there for others to hear. A kind of timelessness was the way in which she characterized his fiction. And interestingly, right after his death, the Southern Illinois University Press published his work, both volumes of his fiction and his poetry. And then Morrison, later on in the early 70s, wanted to have trade editions of his work published so it could get out to a larger audience. And that's what she led, that's what she focused on, she and Eugene B. Redmond.
And how would you describe what you read in his book? You're a professor of English, so what do you see when you read his book?
Well, his fiction there is a timelessness to it, mm-hmm. because most of it, or much of it, is focused on the world that was. And what I mean by that is Dumas was really preoccupied with this idea of African voice, both, primarily oral, right? And what I mean by that is the voice that existed prior to the Atlantic slave trade, that voice was what, in many instances, in the continental U.S., was lost. And so he was preoccupied in his fiction and poetry. You will find African terms or attempts by the speaker or the protagonist to say things that really don't make sense to the English ear, mm-hmm. right? But that in another context would make perfectly good sense. And so Dumas was fascinated with reclaiming that which was lost.
Now, he's a product of the American South, mm-hmm. an American citizen. Did he spend any time in Africa at all?
No.
So how did he hear those voices? How did he hear those turns of phrases, those words, those thoughts that we don't hear?
Right. Well, he heard it in his people. Right? What many people would say was broken English, mm-hmm. or, you know, inappropriate dialect. He heard, he didn't know all the linguistic roots of what he heard in his Southern black Arkansas folk, but he knew that there was something to it, and it shouldn't be diminished or demeaned, but celebrated. And that was inherent in his artistic enterprise, I think. And not just him. Other writers were also fascinated with Africa and all that Africa meant symbolically, right, and historically. And so, no, he didn't have any formal training in linguistics or anything like that, but he understood there's something there.
There were these people who were proponents of his work, particularly after he died, and they pushed hard to get it published, and they were successful. And Toni Morrison called his writing genius. Why was there not a similar passion to tell his story until you decided to tell his story in this book that you wrote?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think, as with all things, oftentimes people know something needs to be done, but they're busy doing other things. And so the question of who's going to do it always presents some challenges. And the other challenge with Dumas, he had a relatively short life, and there really wasn't, in some people's minds, enough archival materials available. And so just from a practical standpoint, some people had stepped away from that. They didn't think that the materials provided by his wife, Loretta Dumas, were enough. And they were right. They were right. And what I was able to do was approach the other woman with whom Dumas was involved. Mm-hmm. He was involved with another woman from 1963 to 1967. And her name was Lois Silber. And now she's Lois Wright. She's been married for over three decades now to the poet, Jay Wright. And she had letters from him covering that four-year period. And I asked her if I could have access to them because they provide the second half, from a chronological standpoint, of his life as I came to understand it.
Had others asked for those papers from her, or were you the first?
I was the first to approach
Why?
Her.
Why do you suppose that is?
I'm not sure. I can tell you why I did, though.
Okay.
I had a conversation with his widow, Loretta Dumas, mm-hmm. and she was very forthcoming, very helpful. But she said, Jeffrey, if you want to do this book, you're going to have to approach Lois Wright. And because there are things that my husband was involved in, engaged in, some good, some not so good, but I have no idea of what they were because our relationship was, at that point, it was on the outs. And so there are literally things that I don't know. So mm-hmm. in writing the book, I've provided her with information that she didn't know about her husband.
Wow.
And again, some of it was positive and some of it, you know, clearly he was involved with another woman. So that's
More than one, evidently.
Right.
Over time.
Yeah, over time.
His life was shrouded, you say, in contradiction. Even the pronunciation of his name mm-hmm. is somewhat in dispute. Henry Dumas, D-U-M-A-S, is it Dumas or is it Dumas, which would be the French pronunciation of it?
Well, at times, I think more often than not, it was Dumas or Dumas.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he was, you know, feeling, you know, especially risque, I think he went with Dumas. And his wife actually pronounces it Dumas. And she says that's how she remembers him pronouncing his surname. But others say Dumas, Dumas.
And you say on page one that his story, until you came along, was like the frame of a house under construction. The outline was clear, but the house was incomplete. And you became compelled to assist in constructing his biographical house.
I did say that.
Was it more work or less work than you thought it was going to be?
Oh, it was definitely more. I had been wanting to write a biography for a while, and I was trying to figure out who my subject would be. Mm-hmm. And Dumas sort of fell into my lap after some conversations with a couple of people. And to the point I made earlier about archival materials, they were limited. Mm-hmm. And so as I began the process, I realized how much of a challenge that was going to be. So when there was no archival record, how did I, or how would I, fill in certain gaps in his life story? But with the assistance of Loretta Dumas and Lois Wright, I was able to piece together, to the best of my ability, I think a valid, fairly accurate, as accurate as you can be about someone's life, reconstruction of his life.
These gaps have been around for a long time because these people that you talk to, like his widow and Lois Wright, are not young anymore.
Exactly.
He was 33 when he died, and they were contemporaries. So they're elderly, and as you say, his widow didn't know certain things. I'm sure that Lois Wright didn't know certain things.
True.
And here you are taking material from both and other sources and putting it all together. Were they not even in the least bit concerned that they might not want to find out everything?
Oh, that was that was certainly part of the conversation. Uh-huh. And to their credit, both said, you know, write what you write, find what you find, we'll be fine. And they didn't implement any restrictions or anything like that. They and again, to their credit, they really wanted the story to be told. They didn't want people just to know that Dumas was a black writer who was shot and killed, that he was more than that. Mm-hmm. And that's a part of his story, certainly, but not the only part.
And the result, you say, has changed altogether what we know about Dumas and his life. He was considered, prior to your book, I know, as a product of the black arts movement. You've already said that, a literary figure heavily involved in political and civil rights. And so how has the picture of him as a person, as a writer, changed as a result of your research and your book?
Well, to give you one example, and we talked about it before the show began, the title of the book, Visible Man, right? That title was what Dumas originally wanted the title of his novel to be, which is called Genoa and the Greenstone, which was published posthumously. But it's a clear, that is, the novel, a rejoinder to Ellison's novel, Ralph Ellison's novel, Invisible Man.
Right.
And Dumas, when he was at Rutgers University, and he was there from roughly 1958 to 1965, he approached Ellison, who was there as writer in residence from 1962 to 1964. He approached Ellison about sort of serving as a literary mentor.
Mm-hmm.
But Ellison didn't take on mentees.
Is it Ellison who didn't particularly care for him?
No, he didn't. Ellison didn't have a reputation for helping young writers, period.
Okay. Right.
But he definitely didn't think much of Henry Dumas's work. And so he was very derogatory in his critique of Dumas. And that, so to have now, at least in sideways fashion, his biography called Invisible Man, I think Dumas would be, I think he would be pleased.
Yeah. We're going to talk more about the book, Visible Man, The Life of Henry Dumas, by our guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Leake from UNC Charlotte, and also hear the story of Henry Dumas's life and why you spent the months and weeks and gosh knows how many years doing this research and writing this book. When we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NS2, presenting guitarist Tommy Emmanuel at McGlowan Theater Monday, June 23rd. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. Here in the Carolinas, the primaries are over. It's now on to the November election, and the campaigns are underway. Last week, we talked politics, candidates, and campaigning with the North Carolina Democratic Party, and tomorrow it is the Republicans' turn. The GOP has been firmly in control of the statehouse. In fact, all branches of government in North Carolina since 2010, and well, they're looking to mount a serious challenge to unseat incumbent Democratic Senator Kay Hagan. So we take a look at all of that and more with one of the heads of the North Carolina Republican Party tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama sends nearly 300 troops to boost security at the American Embassy in Baghdad. Al-Qaeda-inspired insurgents continue to expand areas of control, the crisis in Iraq, and the possibility of U.S.-Iranian cooperation.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Leek, director of the Center of the Study of the New South and an associate professor of English at UNC Charlotte and the author of Visible Man, The Life of Henri Dumas, who was a literary figure in the mid-20th century, died at the age of 33 on a subway platform in Harlem. That's just part of his story, but it's a story that you call a two-part mystery. That's part two of the mystery. What was part one?
Well, part one involved his, you know, early years growing up in Arkansas, and basically you had asked earlier, you know, sort of why spend the time to write the book. Before my book, if you did a Google search on Dumas, you would find the who, the what, the when, the where, the basic sketches of his life. But left out of that was the why. Why did he move from Arkansas to Harlem, for example? That's sort of the easiest question to answer. It's Jim Crow South. He wants to get out, or his family wants him to have other opportunities. But why does he then, after graduating high school, why does he go to the Air Force? Why does he decide in leaving the Air Force to go to Rutgers? Why does he leave Rutgers and go to East St. Louis, right? And so it was all of those whys that I was fascinated by, because that to me was where that was the meat of the story. Why is he doing these things? What either externally or internally was going on in his life?
And what interested you more? Why were you interested? I guess the question is, why were you interested in the first place? Were you more interested from an English language and a writing point of view, or from a historical point of view, from this man's contributions, which were have been praised posthumously? But I mean, what was the key interest for you?
Probably a little bit of both, but if I had to narrow it down, I would say my main question was, if he's the writer that Morrison says he was and others, then why do we not have a biography? Why do we not have a fuller exploration of this important literary figure?
Were you at all worried that you'd reach a dead end, or that you'd find out something that would make him less of a figure than you thought he was?
Well, the main thing that I thought would pose a problem, I've mentioned the other woman he was married to, Lois. No, he wasn't married to her. He was involved with her. And she was Jewish. She's a Jewish woman with whom he's involved in the mid-60s, right? And that scene that he was in, it would have been the Beat Movement, if you will, which preceded the Black Arts Movement. That scene put him in interaction with white writers, white artists, all of whom are younger than he is, right? Because when he goes to college, he's 5 years or so older than his classmates, because he's gone to the military and come back. So the things that I would learn about him, to some degree, partying or just enjoying a kind of social life that was not characteristic of him earlier, right? And that for some people would perhaps diminish his reputation, right? He wasn't a bad person by any stretch, but, you know, he engaged in behavior in the 60s that was somewhat risque.
But that was the 60s.
Right, exactly. So I did my best to contextualize that. And what I've told some people is that he got married in 1955. He had his first child. They had their first child in 1958. And from a social standpoint, I've told my students this. In 1959, the birth control pill was patented, right? And so for the first time, you've got college-age students who can engage in romantic and sexual activity without
risk.
relatively speaking,
yeah.
right? And so he missed out on that initially, right? And so the 60s represents, in that regard, and I would say in broader cultural terms, a major shift in possibility,
right.
not just in terms of romantic relationships, but culturally, right? And in terms of gender relations, because the 1960s is when women, for the first time, have major options after college that don't have to do with finding a husband
right.
necessarily. And so it's a wide open period, and he falls squarely into that, and he's impacted by it.
Well, let's hear his story, because you've alluded to some of the items. And he grew up in the 30s and 40s in Sweet Home, Arkansas. What a great name.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little south of Little Rock, and mm-hmm. found himself in Harlem as a 10-year-old boy. Entered the Air Force, moved in the last year of his life to East St. Louis, but died in Harlem. But talk about those earlier Arkansas and early Harlem influences on not only his life, but perhaps how it impacted what he wrote and what he wrote about.
Right. Well, I'll start with his home, Sweet Home. For those who are interested, Toni Morrison's, the plantation where her novel Beloved is set, mm-hmm. is called Sweet Home Plantation in Beloved. People think that's a direct reference to Dumas. She has said that's not the case, but whether it is or not, there's a clear, at least unintended connection.
Right.
But Sweet Home was a place where Dumas ran till he, you know, fell asleep, where he could ride his bike, where he was fascinated with nature. He would stay out hours just sitting under a tree and listening to the sounds, observing the birds, all that's out there in nature. And that is sort of a recurring theme in his poetry and fiction. In fact, I would say that his best of both is usually that which is focused on nature. And he thinks, as I read his writing, for him, the South and his birthplace are the site for Black people in particular reconnecting with themselves. That there's something about this place that nurtures him in his childhood years. And it represents both the joy, the beauty, and the pain of being Black and Southern.
Well, you've brought in a couple of things that he wrote, and one of them is a poem called mm-hmm. Son of Mississippi, which is not exactly Arkansas, but it's close, it's nearby.
Right.
Does this have something? Is that a good example of what you're talking about?
It is, and not only is it a reference to, you know, the state of Mississippi, but the Mississippi River,
okay.
which is symbolic in terms of our cultural imagination in America. I mean, that's the central place in Huck Finn,
right
for Mark Twain. And so depending on where you are on the river, you're slave or free,
okay.
you know, as we find in Twain's novel, right? And so Mississippi represents both the river and the state.
You want to read part of that?
Sure, I'll read a couple of stanzas from it.
Okay.
Son of Mississippi. Up from Mississippi I grew. Bear walk and cane stalk make a hungry belly talk. Up from the river of death, walk bear and stalk cane make a hungry belly talk. Up from Mississippi I grew, up from the river of pain. And I'll end there. And I don't know if the listeners caught this, but the first two stanzas that I read, the second stanza, in terms of the words, are reversed. So in the first stanza, it reads bear walk and cane stalk. In the second stanza, it's walk bear and stalk cane. In other words, no matter how you word it, the speaker is saying, this is my place. I'm part of this place, right? No matter how much you try to render me invisible, mm-hmm. I'm part of the organic landscape of this place. And
it wouldn't be working without me.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And so he leaves, yes, but in terms of his writing, the South is there. It's forever present. And
but he was 10 when he left. Mm-hmm. So a 10-year-old goes through a lot of maturation between 10 and 20.
Sure.
So why was it so ingrained in him when he then moved to Harlem at the age of 10, a whole new world, completely different world?
Well, that it shows just the imprint of home, right? Mm-hmm. And how he leaves, yes, but he understands that this is where everything began.
It's like Romare Bearden, who left here,
sure,
for mm-hmm. New York, and this is he painted about this for years afterward.
He took Mecklenburg County with him.
Okay.
Right? And so home is a physical space, uh-huh. yes, but it's also where your head uh-huh. is, where your heart is.
Why did his family move to Harlem?
Well, interestingly, his family initially didn't. He did. He had an aunt who moved to Harlem, and he went up to visit one summer, and he was fascinated by it, just by the opportunities, and this aunt had married a man significantly older than she was. So she was a stay-at-home wife. Her husband, Uncle John, was a truck driver, and he was able to provide a really good home. And so Henry asked his mom if he could stay with Aunt Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he went up there, and so did his mom. And his mom worked as a domestic, as a housekeeper in Arkansas, and she went and found a job doing that same kind of work in New York. And though his mom was a domestic, she had a really cosmopolitan sensibility. She loved going to new places. She loved nice clothes. And so she sort of planted in him this healthy fascination with the world beyond wherever you happen to be.
What made him enlist in the Air Force?
Well, that's one of the things that I learned as I was doing my research. After high school, he went to City College of New York, and he enrolled. He took two courses and did well in them. They were like Introduction to Music and maybe Freshman Comp, two basic courses. But I later learned that he had a crisis of confidence when he was in college. He didn't feel like he was ready. He didn't feel like he was prepared. He felt like he had been somewhat coddled in high school or spoiled. And here he is at City College. And while he did well, he just didn't feel like he was making the grade intellectually. Not so much in terms of his marks.
How did you find that out?
I was sifting through his papers that his wife gave me access to.
He wrote about it.
Yes, yes. He wrote what he did in an essay for an English class at Rutgers years later.
Huh.
He wrote about his high school or his immediate post-high school experience. And so I found the letter, and his wife hadn't even noticed that. And so I said, oh, This is key.
Did he allude to what caused, or did he understand what caused the crisis of confidence?
For him, it was simply the transition from being a child
right.
to having to become an adult, right? And that seems to have been the gist of it, but it was powerful enough for him to step back and say, I need to do something
else. So he saw the Air Force as a way to grow up?
Yes. Yes, and maybe seek the experience that he felt he was lacking.
He was stationed in the Air Force somewhere on the Arabian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that we had a base on the Arabian Peninsula back then, but he became an observer of Islam, not a convert, an
right.
observer, which caused his Christianity, you say, to become more conservative.
Yes.
Why was that because he was impressed with the conservative practices of the people who were devoutly Muslim?
Yes, yes. He was impressed. And actually, his experience in the Arabian Peninsula is the first example that we have of his writing. He wrote maybe a 20-page handwritten essay about his experiences there. And one of the things that he says is that the Muslim is disciplined, the Muslim is devout, and we should, as a culture, as an American mm-hmm. culture, we should appreciate their commitment to their religion. So he's almost speaking as an anthropologist, almost, just observing what they do. He doesn't feel inclined to become a Muslim. But he does use that, and when he comes back here in 1954, 1955, he, within a year and a half, he's adopted a much more evangelical approach to his own Christian development. In fact, when he goes to Rutgers University in 1958, people think he's a preacher. They think he's there to get a degree in religious studies. They think he's a preacher. And within a year and a half, he totally shifts.
Yeah, let's talk, because for a while you say he had an all-or-nothing approach to Jesus. If you mm-hmm. didn't know Jesus like he knew Jesus, then you didn't know Jesus. And then, as you say, in a couple of years, he shifted into it, then he shifted away from it. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a recurring pattern among many aspects of his life. Do you think he could have been bipolar or ADHD or some other...
Right. Back then, we didn't have those diagnoses. He certainly, and I think I say at some point in the book.
Or that, just a guy experimenting because he was young.
Right. And he has a roaming intellect.
Mm-hmm.
He's interested. He's like a journalist in that sense. He likes to go from thing to thing. But to your point about ADHD or being bipolar, there was a history of depression in his family. His father was a functional alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
and his two sons, and this goes beyond the purview of my book because I'm not really looking at their lives, but both his children in the late 80s and early 90s would commit suicide, mm-hmm. and they both had been diagnosed with clinical depression. So, and that, of course, made it very difficult for his wife, their mother, because the three men in her life, three primary men, died, and two, you know, her children killed themselves.
I mean, because he came back from the Arabian Peninsula almost an evangelical Christian. People thought he was a preacher, as you said. While at Rutgers, though, he kind of moved into this white literary cultural mm-hmm. milieu and had several relationships with white women. And then, in the year before his death, he decided to eschew relationships with white people and moved into a mostly black world, and he considered the merits of cultural nationalism. Mm-hmm. He dabbled, you say, in drugs and alcohol. What was going on there? And we have 15 seconds. I'll tell you what. Answer that. Think about that. That question after the break. We're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Leek, the author of Visible Man, The Life of Henri Dumas. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Charlotte Graduate School, offering graduate certificates from energy analytics to nonprofit management, open houses held on campus and online. Details at gradcertificate.uncc.edu. President Obama sends nearly 300 troops to boost security at the American Embassy in Baghdad as al-Qaeda-inspired insurgents continue to expand areas of control. On the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they discuss the crisis in Iraq and the possibility of U.S.-Iranian cooperation. That's coming up in 20 minutes. By the way, our guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Leek, will be signing his book, Visible Man, The Life of Henri Dumas, at Park Road Books on Saturday, June 21st at 2 p.m. You're invited to that. You're also invited to join us at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or through Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Every day, public radio journalists go where the story is.
Egyptian bomb squads are examining the scene of the explosion in Nasser City.
In Pakistan, militants armed with heavy weapons have attacked a prison.
Kenyan authorities say there was no one left inside, but the Kenyan Red Cross says there's still 71 people missing.
Count on public radio journalists for vital news from all corners of the globe.
Stay connected with global and local news throughout the day on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the life of Henry Dumas, as chronicled in a book called Visible Man by our guest today, Dr. Jeffrey Leek, who is a professor of English at UNC Charlotte. We were talking about Henry Dumas and the conflicts, which, you know, many people have these conflicts, these things that they deal with in their life that seem to be at odds with each other, but they end up making up the sum of the parts of the individual. And we talked about how he came back from the Arabian Peninsula in the Air Force and was impressed by Islamic fundamentalist, not even fundamental, just Islamic devoutness to Islam, and thought that Christians ought to admire that. And he mm-hmm. began to practice it in his own Christianity, became evangelical almost in his approach, but then got caught up in this literary scene and some of the sexual freedom of the 1960s, which is the antithesis of evangelical Christianity. How do you explain all of this stuff going on in his life?
Well, he's certainly a product of that moment. And I think, unfortunately for us, there are many people who experience similar things, but they lived to move on. And so the problem with his story is that he's killed in 1968, and so he doesn't have 2, 3, 4 more decades.
Right. He's frozen in time.
Right, right. And so his life is certainly exciting and in some ways riveting, to at least for me, to have written about. But by the same token, I had to remind myself that he is caught in time, if you will. But I think when he gets to Rutgers, he really gets a taste of sort of the possibilities of becoming a writer. Mm. And he's there at first with other white men, for the most part, who will become significant writers. Alan Chews, who's a prominent NPR book reviewer, is one of his classmates. Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate, mm-hmm. Spoke very highly of him. In fact, he said that in class, he was the go-to person for the professor whenever they needed clarification with regard to biblical references. So here he is. He's interacting with, for the most part, future white male writers. And they're impressed with him. He's holding his own. Mm-hmm, and as he immerses himself in that context, he starts to do things socially that are, you know, beyond what he would have done 3, 5, 7 years ago. Yeah. And so he just becomes a part of that world. And then eventually, as you say, he moves back toward this idea of a black cultural.
When he made a shift, and this seems to be a pattern through his life, and I don't know how much to make of this, because when you're a young kid, kids have a tendency to become absorbed in one thing or another, mm-hmm. to the exclusion of almost everything else. But and to a lesser degree, he seems to have followed that course through his young life. But you say that as a young man, he would dive into an interest just like that, like classical music, which
That's
something
right.
his parents did not appreciate because they saw it as an elitist form of music of the white tradition that saw blacks as being inferior. But he was completely absorbed by it. Later, he would become influenced by jazz, again, the antithesis of classical music.
Right.
Is this what's going on here? I mean, is he just exploring, or is he opening his eyes and just dabbling in things to the point where he really wants to understand it, does understand it,
and
moves
then,
on?
And then moves on, right. And for him, that's definitely the theme. If you wanted to isolate one theme in his life or characteristic, he's definitely diving in mm-hmm. and then moving on, right? And so for blues, jazz, right, his relationship with the jazz musician Sun Ra, mm-hmm. right, which was this, I mean, Sun Ra was a totally avant-garde figure in the 1960s and, well beyond that. But when Dumas encountered him, he felt like he had met sort of the musical equivalent of what he aspired to be as a literary person.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, often we want to lock people in, artists, writers, in to a specific genre, right, or category of expression, if it's a musician. And with artists, they tend not to think like that. We tend to think like that if we're historians, literary folks. That provides a good way for us to explain his or her significance. But artists just go with what interests them.
Yeah.
And sometimes it may make sense to us. Other times it may not.
And did these all work their way somehow into his writing or into his literary point of view? Because you do say he came to see fiction as a way of processing actual events.
Yes, and I while I wouldn't read his fiction or his poetry as, you know, solely autobiographical, I think there are autobiographical elements, and certainly elements that give you insight into some of the things that he was thinking about. And, you know, if it's okay, I'll share an excerpt from his posthumously published novel, Genoa and the Greenstone, which, again, he would have titled Visible Man. And just a little context, the novel is about a black man's flight from the South, a young black man's flight from the South, Jim Crow and all that oppression, and his return in the 60s to the South. And so he's filled with ambivalence about returning, and he's probably filled with even more ambivalence about having left in the first place. And his name is Genoa. And so here's the excerpt. "But I had fled the South, drifted, played a few songs for college kids, told my story here and there, collected money and wasted it, ran and ran. Fear and terror scrape out the bottom of one's soul. I was almost reduced by the fear of the rope and the terror I had seen my family and friends suffer and die by. I chose the safety of my dreams and the warmth of ignorance. But it was always Jubal's voice in the songs that came ringing back into my mind like an arrow shot out of the sky." And Jubal is his brother or his stepbrother in the story. And when he says Jubal's voice, he's really talking about what we were referencing earlier in terms of that language, that Southern black idiom for Dumas, or in the story, for Genoa, that's represented in his brother. Genoa has gone off and sort of learned the ways of the world, but he's forgotten his roots. And his roots are represented in his stepbrother's voice. And they're a reminder that though you left, this is still with you, and you need to honor this. You need to honor, as one of his stories is titled, the sacred ark of bones that are here in the South. Here's where blood was shed, whether you're talking about the Civil War or the Middle Passage. Here's where you have to reconcile things. And until you do that, you will be running, which is what the protagonist in the novel does for a great part of it.
Is writing a way for him to work out a lot of things that are just rumbling around, you think, in his head? Because you talk about he loved his wife, but he had a four-year relationship with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
He became heavily involved in the civil rights movement, but didn't talk about it at home. And obviously he has this fascination with, maybe even guilt, for leaving the South, wants to go home, can't quite get there. Is that all playing out in his head and therefore in his writing?
Yes, to a large degree. We all have multiple sides to ourselves, but his are especially pronounced. And I think he uses his art to try to make sense of those things. But as you pointed out, yes, he's married, he's in a relationship. He at one point is sort of interacting more with the white literary set.
Mm-hmm.
He moves away from them and thinks he needs to go all black, right, for the most part, culturally speaking, when he's in East St. Louis. And so he's trying to – he's a microcosm of that period.
Of that time. Okay. Mm-hmm. He was also invited to join the Nation of Islam.
He was.
But he never did, although he kept, you say, the letter of invitation.
Yes, and what I think was going on there – he wanted to get a better sense of the nation, and so he, you know, sent in a letter of interest, mm-hmm. and they sent him back an acceptance letter that said, here's all you need to do. And he kept the letter because, you know, I have a copy of it, but he never joined. No one who knows him can document any encounter that he had with the nation. But he would have an interesting encounter with Malcolm X.
How so?
Well, when he was at Rutgers, Malcolm X came to the campus, and he ruffled some feathers, if you will. Yes, college campus, predominantly white student body, and Malcolm X is going to say the kinds of things that would ruffle the white privileged class. And what Dumas and a friend of his, Earl Thomas, were able to do after Malcolm spoke, they went out to dinner with him and interviewed him, basically, but he wouldn't allow them to tape the interview. And I was able to get this information from Earl Thomas, whom I interviewed, and, you know, he shared that the interview went well and that their impression of Malcolm X was that there was the Malcolm who was out on TV. Mm-hmm. And in pulpits, you know, preaching black nationalism, but that Malcolm was not the Malcolm they sat down to dinner with. The Malcolm they sat down to dinner with was more practical in his orientation and thinking about race and how best for black folks to get a fair opportunity.
And he wrote a letter to the editor of the Rutgers newspaper responding to a negative editorial about Malcolm X, in which he says he saw that he saw black Muslims as a sign of the Negro in America becoming a visible man. So he did see value, even if he didn't join.
Right. He didn't agree necessarily with all that the nation was proposing, but he definitely embraced this idea of, you know, one, making it clear to whites that, you know, we're here and you've got to deal with us. And Malcolm epitomized that. And so that was central for Dumas.
You teach young people at the university level for whom all of this is ancient history. Just in terms of what you write about his life and his experiences in the 50s and 60s, until his death, is it of eye-opening value to them to understand what that world was like and what he went through to live in that world at that time?
Well, I think so. And the way I frame it, and this for me, the benefit to teaching about the 50s and the 60s is that we're on a college campus, university campus, and students can at least identify with what he and those of his generation, what transformational changes occurred.
Because he's their age?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. He's a little older, but he's still experiencing, in other words, what they take for granted now in terms of certain kinds of experiences, what we take for granted in terms of women on college campuses. Mm-hmm. When he was at Rutgers, there was a separate smaller college for women at Rutgers called Douglas College. Now, women are totally integrated.
You've called his writing timeless. So is it as helpful to understanding that time as your book is, or is it simply just a literary experience that could be anytime, anywhere, anyplace?
The latter. I think it's he in his literature is interested in the larger questions about who we are as a people, as African Americans, as Americans, as Southerners, right? And so it's the big questions that his fiction is concerned with. And if you like, I can read part of a letter that he wrote to Viking Press, trying to get them to consider publishing or giving him a contract for his novel. And he says, briefly, my novel covers about a 30-year period from the 1930s to the present, the span of the major character's age. It begins in the South where I was born, weaves northward, and returns to the South. I attempt to throw a vivid spotlight upon the curious mosaic of race in America and the terrible maladies afflicting Americans, not because of race, but because of their inability to deal with mistakes of the past and their inability to handle the changes of the present. The major theme is primarily man in search of himself. It is an odyssey of the Negro, but a psychosocial odyssey in which man is confronted with the problem of good and evil.
And is his book successful at doing that?
Yes, Genoa and the Greenstone is successful at doing that, but it's not, it's unfinished in that he died before it was published and his literary executor had to arrange it. So we don't have the final composition that Dumas.
Before I let you go, Dr. Jeffrey Leake, he died on a subway platform in Harlem, and it's still shrouded in mystery. Do you have a better understanding of what happened that day from your research? And I have 10 seconds.
I have a better understanding. It was a white rookie transit cop confronting a black man who was probably not in the best mental state. And that, in sum, is what the...
And you can read more about it in
right.
Visible Man, The Life of Henry Dumas by Jeffrey Leake. Thanks for the hour.